All right. Why don't we look at this little chart here? Before we get to the middle block there, the two blocks to the side, the natural creation block at the top on the left and the no creation block on the right. What would be the no creation? We kind of talked about that a little bit, that steady state. Could somebody explain that? Not quite. The no creation one would be the steady state model. Do you remember us talking about that? It kind of is the opposite of the Big Bang, where the Big Bang reveals a beginning, where this one reveals... Yeah, it's always been this way. There's no beginning. And that was the current... That was the dominant scientific view of the universe up until about 1960. So two-thirds of scientists before 1960 held to the steady-state position. And then what happened around 1960? Well, we started getting a pile of evidence of the Big Bang. So the standard model of the Big Bang started to gain a lot of recognition in the scientific community. So people started changing their views. And so over on the left, you have the natural creation. Now, we talked about various views last week of the natural creation. Can somebody identify one of those views we brought up? We talked about, we didn't really talk about the Big Bang, but we talked about alternative versions that are naturalistic. Do you remember that? You probably remember one of them.
Oh, the one that is the boundless finite.
There you go. Universe. Yes. Which you investigated a little bit more this week.
I tried to understand.
Yeah. Any others you remember from last week?
The multiverse.
The multiverse is one. Yeah. So there's a few alternative views to the origin of the universe besides the Big Bang. But we didn't talk about the Big Bang, so we're going to do that tonight. And the idea here with natural creation is that, except for the Big Bang, you really have something like the steady state model, because the whole idea of the multiverse and the black hole created universes, do you remember that? And the boundless finite model, all of these have to do with basically an infinitely old universe, or an eternal series of universes, a multiverse, if you will, or a bunch of universes that essentially create each other, like a black hole created another universe, and within that universe, a black hole created another universe. So you have just energy being transferred through black holes to expand and create another universe. The same kind of idea is true with the multiverse. And we talked about why those theories don't work. We talked about how they didn't have a lot of evidence. So the Big Bang then would be also another natural creation version to the origin of the universe. And we're going to talk about that tonight as possibly an example or an approach that Christians can adopt and take on as helpful in explaining how the universe was created by God. And again, that would be considered an old earth position. So if you look at the center block there, supernatural creation with intelligent design. We talked a lot about intelligent design earlier. So you have the young earth and the old earth position as options for the Christian who hold to a supernatural creation. So in the young earth position on the left, you have flood geology and ideal time. That should be time theory. Not sure why the E is cut off. But we're not going to talk about the young earth position tonight. We'll talk about that next week. So tonight we're going to talk about old earth to the right. Now you have three views, essentially, that you could kind of consolidate into these three here. Or you have a bunch of views you can consolidate into these. You have the other views. We'll just call it that for now because they're less popular. And then you have the progressive creation view, which is gaining a lot of popularity, and the theistic evolution view, which is also gaining a lot of popularity. And within progressive creation and theistic evolution, you have a series of views there. And so we're going to look at theistic evolution tonight, and we'll start progressive creation next week. So next week we'll look at progressive creation and young earth. And then tonight we're going to look at the other less popular views and theistic evolution. And as a disclaimer, you could see there at the bottom, I'm not advocating any of these positions. and I'm not opposing them. I'm going to present them to you. And other than like before, when I was arguing against certain positions, I'm not going to argue for you to believe one of them. I want you to make up your own mind. I'm going to present everything as best as I can, as neutrally as I can, and try to not disclose what position I hold up until the very last second of the class, essentially, so that you could kind of look at this and be the judge yourself, because I want to respect you and your mind's capability and see what stands out as we consider this stuff. And that way you won't burn me at the stake either, because I know some of you are very passionate about a certain view. So let's see here. Why don't we go ahead and get going on page 2. So the old earth creation position. Old earth creationism is a valid position. So when I say valid, I don't mean true. I just, at this point, I'm just saying it's valid. Somebody could hold this and be a Christian and consider it to be viable with the text of the scripture. So what is old earth creation? Before we go into it, can someone just summarize it for us in a nutshell? I mean, we're going to talk about all the details, but does somebody know what it is and would like to just spout it out? What are some of the key components to the old earth creation position?
Lots of time.
Lots of time. What else?
Day may have been a day of time.
Yes. Day may have been a long period of time. What else? Is anybody here... I won't ask that. Have you ever thought about being an old earth creationist? Have you ever at least considered it? Let me just ask it that way. Have you thought about this position as a Christian? No, yes, 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 yes. So many of us have considered it as an option. Well, according to this view, the earth and the universe are very old, several billions of years. The creation account in Genesis is somehow, in some way, shape, and form, not completely literal in every aspect. So the word yom, the Hebrew root word for day, doesn't mean a literal 24 hours. Rather, it is an age or an epoch of time. Okay, so the day could mean an epoch of time. A day, quote, unquote, is... in Genesis, may represent billions of years. It may. It may only represent like 36 hours, but it could also represent like 5 billion years, you know, something like that. The old Earth creationism is sometimes referred to as OEC or day-age views. So if you see OEC anywhere in a book you're reading or the day-age view, this is just another word for old Earth creationism. Now, this view typically includes these three components. The Big Bang occurred. God caused the Big Bang as his initial act of creation. And God continued to create over time as described in Genesis. So God caused the Big Bang, but then did some other stuff after that in some way, at some time, who knows when. Now, the proposed timeline, to give you a general sense of how this unfolds, is essentially this. The Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago. Sometimes people just say 15 billion years ago. The Earth was formed about 4.5 million years ago. And the single-celled or very primitive life forms, like bacteria, formed about 3 billion years ago on the Earth. And then we talked about the abiogenesis views in the past. And modern humans were formed less than 100,000 years ago. So comparatively speaking, humanity's only been around for 100,000 years, or hominids or human-like creatures have only been around for 100,000 years. And that's nothing compared to a 13.7 billion-year-old universe. Now, there's a strange table there, a chart, that didn't come out at all. And I'm very sorry about that, because when I sent it over to the school here to get printed for you, it came out just fine. So I have it here on this cool little guy, and I'm going to pass it around because I really want to see it, want you to see it. If you could just take a look at it and pass it along, it's kind of there. there. You could kind of... Anyway, if you look closely at this thing, it's hard to read, and I apologize. It was extremely clear. I somehow messed up. But if you look there, day one to the right has this kind of faded thing going on, and it flows down to that timeline there, billions of years in the white, and it starts at 4.5, and then as the page goes down, that 4.5 steadily decreases to 0.5. So the day one represents essentially 4.5 billion years ago to about 3.0 billion years ago. Do you see that? And then day two would go from 3.0 to 2.0. And then as you can see, those other bar charts kind of in the middle of that whole diagram, those represents that represents items that are being created, organisms that are being created, or planetary bodies or oceans or something that's coming about. It's popping into existence, essentially. And so that kind of gives you a general sense of when things took place or when things were formed in relation to time, either astronomically or in the universe. Okay, this isn't working out too well. All right, we'll look at that at the break. I'll display it over there. But this is a really cool table, and I'll kind of show it off to you at the break or something. Okay, and so that's the general idea. So if you really want to know, like, okay, well, when did, like, zebras show up, you know, according to this view, if they weren't created on the fifth day, then you could kind of look here and say, okay, well, if you hold to the old Earth creationist position, you could find out when they would show up. Of course, they would be very recent. And all the other stuff before that, you know, you wouldn't really recognize. Like all those strange cells and eukaryotes, things like that. So this just is a helpful tool. So I would recommend you, if you want, I can email this to you. Now, scientific support down there at the bottom, page 3, for this view is taken from essentially a few areas of science. Astronomy and cosmology, of course. We talked about the Big Bang. Chemistry, geology, and biology. Okay? Now, if you hold to the Big Bang position, this view doesn't necessarily entail that you're an evolutionist or a macroevolutionist. You can hold to OEC and not hold to macroevolution. That's fine. Just giving you a heads up. So, one doesn't necessitate the other. Now, except for the fact if you're a hold to biological macroevolution, then you would definitely hold to OEC. But if you hold to OEC, it doesn't mean you hold to macroevolution. Now, as far as astronomy and cosmology, what sort of evidence is there in astronomy and cosmology for an old Earth position? I mean, how do we know using our satellites and telescopes that the universe is super old? Okay, we can see stars billions of light years away. Okay. How do we know they're billions of light years away? The speed of light, okay. Their relative velocity. Redshift. Keyword. Remember that word? Hi. There's an outline there in the back if you want it, 14. What else? When we look through our telescope, how do we know things are old? Things are decaying, breaking apart, perhaps, okay? All right, well, why don't we get into this a little bit and see if we can uncover some more. Well, all older theories agree that the findings of modern astrophysics and astronomy are accurate descriptions of the universe, and the widely held position of the scientific community on the age of the universe, roughly 14 billion years, is correct. So if you're an old earther and the scientific community says the universe is 14 billion years old, you're going to say, okay, it is. I like it. Thank you. Proponents point to the age of individual stars. So that's one key way we understand the age of the universe. When we know the chemistry of a star, that sort of thing, its mass, its brightness, how many isotopes it has, or just something like this. You can identify the age of that star. So that's one way. But mainly, it's the Big Bang. And so proponents point to the following observations by Edwin Hubble, way back, say, 60, 70 years ago, to help understand the age of the universe. So because there's uniformity in the cosmos, which means that based on our observable region, when we go look in space, it's isotropic, meaning it's uniform, it's homogeneous. That's a key assumption that we are making. When we look through telescopes, we're seeing that the space is uniform. It's evenly distributed, a bunch of stars. Yeah, they may be scattered at different dimensions and measurements from each other, but in general, as a whole, it's evenly distributed. When observing distant galaxies from a massive telescope, Hubble observed that a color shift occurs from red to dark red for the fainter galaxies. That is, red shifts increase with the apparent faintness. So that means fainter galaxies implies farther galaxies. So red shifts increase with distance. Has anyone ever heard of this before? Somewhat familiar to more than a couple of us? No, just a couple of us. Okay, well, good. Got some new stuff for you. For you too, you can be bored for a couple minutes. So, item 4. This relationship is linear. The more the red shift, the further the distance. So, Hubble interpreted this red shift as motion. And so when red changed to violet, it meant that it was coming closer. And when red went to darker red, it meant that it was moving away. It was receding. So just based on the change in the color when he looked in his telescope, he was able to determine how, basically, that it was further and it was moving away, or it was closer and it was coming towards us. So he says, with a little reserve, the nebulae, the stars, are supposed to be rushing away from our region of space with velocities that increase directly with distance. So acceleration, essentially. Now, since the universe is uniform, it is reasonable to conclude that red shifts occur throughout the universe and that motion of the galaxies is occurring throughout the universe. So this is important. He saw a certain amount of stars. He concluded that these are coming closer, these are moving away, and therefore he extrapolated and said, okay, this must be occurring all over the universe. Later he stated this phenomena, we stated this phenomena as Hubble's law, which is basically red shifts are linearly proportional to its distance and inversely proportional to its apparent brightness. So that should just give you a sense of what this is about. Astronomers can quickly point to many places in space where this occurs. So now, 70 years later, we have just tremendous amount of evidence of this same phenomena. So a standard resource for this is this book here, if you want to get more information, obviously. The following observations by Georges Lemaître, I think that's how I say his name, advanced Hubble's finds. So it didn't stop there. There's more information. So let's call him Lemaître for short. Further developed and advanced Hubble's findings into a full theory of cosmic expansion. Okay, the motion of the galaxies that are very far represent an old universe as motion relates to time. So he basically took Hubble's observations and his telescopes and he basically was saying, okay, well, now that you've identified how these things are moving closer or further from us, we can figure out what's happening. Well, if something is in motion, it has to do with time. And it appears, basically, in item 3 there, that motion is expanding from an originating point. So that when we look at all these stars and we kind of identify their motion and where they're going, we can see that they seem to be coming from an individual singularity. If it's expanding, what is it expanding from? There must have been a time when it was in a more contract state. If something is expanding, we keep observing it expand, well, it must have been more contract. So we just continue to think that way and reason that way, and the further back we go, the more the mass is concentrated in a tighter region. Tighter, tighter region you go, all of a sudden you get to this infinitely dense singularity. And he proposed an original primal atom that contained the whole matter of the world. So you have basically infinite density in an infinitesimal small space. That is mind-boggling to imagine, right? But we can think about it easily if we think about a black hole, because we know what those do. Those take everything around it, they suck it into an infinite density, and then it's basically gone, at least from our observation. Question?
Yes, which is the primal atom, the example of a singularity.
Yeah. Yeah, now, I'm going to say something more about that in a second. Eight. This atom exploded, and the expanding universe is what followed. So basically, you have this atom, infinitesimal space, and infinite density, and he basically said that we can conclude that any general process of condensation occurring in a world where the kinetic energy does not vanish must induce expansion. So he was able to reason that once you get to this contracted space, it basically blew up because there's all this energy confined, and then blew up again. And that's this idea that this theory became known as the Big Bang. Now, to make this, if that seems simple enough, but to make it confusing, there's this idea that, see, this is what we're saying, is that you just have this extreme explosion, and everybody kind of knows this is kind of what the Big Bang is all about, right? Well, if you think about it, it's not that simple once you get into the cosmology. So the idea is that, and you can't draw this, but space itself is expanding. Space everywhere is expanding. Okay? So think about a string, for instance, across the room, and say someone's holding it over there and holding it over there, and they're trying to pull it to expand it. Well, think about how if the string was able to just expand itself, that another inch just suddenly showed up and they were able to move back an inch. And then over here, another inch showed up and they were able to move back an inch. And so on and so forth. So eventually, as these inches just popped up all over the place, they were able to move miles and miles and miles away. Inches just appear along the string out of nowhere. Space itself was expanding. This is the idea of the Big Bang. And it relates to this idea that we kind of talked about last time of the space-time continuum. The space-time surface, if you will. Have you ever heard of this? Okay, so when people are talking about space-time warps, wormholes, things like this, general relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, this is the idea, is that space relates to time and time relates to space. And whenever you have something expand, the other is going to expand too. So anybody here, someone who's an expert on general or special relativity? Does anyone want to attempt to volunteer to explain that? Okay. It's very complicated, but the idea, quickly, is that, and this is just what's told to me. I haven't researched this myself from Einstein or anything, but from what I understand, it's the idea that gravity and velocity, if they are increasing on a planetary body, then time is decreasing, or time slows down. And that's only relative to an observer on another planetary body. So, for instance, if I'm on a body that is on a planetary, say a star or a planet, that's like a trillion times heavier than the Earth, well, time there, when I observe it from the Earth, is going to be slowed down. And from their observation of us, time here is going really, really, really fast. Okay? So this is kind of the idea. So relative to from one place to another, you have a time differential, time dilation is what it's called. And so what Einstein figured out is there's this relationship between space and time. So the space-time continuum or surface, if you will, is could warp, it could bend. And it's hard to explain, hard to draw, so we don't have to get there. But I'm just trying to give you, put a little imprint in your mind when you think about the Big Bang. It's not as simple as it appears. It's not just that. There's something more to it. And it has to do with relativity theory or law. Yes? Okay, awesome. Yeah, well, that'd be great. And stick it in the back there. Well, we're not going to get into it tonight. Yeah, you can stick it in the bag. People are interested. But the point I'm trying to make is that the Big Bang is the expansion of space itself. And the idea is that bodies are accelerating through space because space itself is pushing them as the inches develop, if you will. Okay, so there's more to it than that. Now, when you talk about a singularity, you're not just talking about an infinitesimal point in space that's extremely small, like 0.001 inches in diameter. You're talking about a singularity of space and time, at both. So it's a space-time singularity. So it gets a little weird. Okay? So I just want to give you a heads up in case you get in a conversation with someone on the street and they're telling you that this is just the child's model of the Big Bang. You don't really know the adult version, you know. There's more to it. So, again, this class is kind of to whet your appetite, so you kind of do your own research. So I hope that intrigues you. Now, the last thing there, it is not necessary to adopt Big Bang theory for one to be an old Earth creationist. However, one must provide an alternative view that explains how the universe came to be and the observations of astrophysics and astronomy in relation to this view. So if you want to be an OEC person, and that's your position, and you say, I hate the Big Bang, it sucks, and you're mad at it for some reason, you know, you just don't like it, then you have to figure out how to explain the astronomical observations that we see, that we know about, and the origin of the universe. And so most people just hold to the standard Big Bang model. So it's difficult to provide a qualified alternative view, and so old Earth creationists easily adopt the Big Bang theory. And so, again, the dominant view for the last 2,500 years, essentially since Aristotle in Greece, was that the universe was eternal, and the change in views around 1960 to a Big Bang model represent a huge shift in the seismic community. And it's interesting that many in the seismic community didn't want to accept the Big Bang because they knew that if you accepted a Big Bang, you would accept a banger. Or if you accepted a beginning of the universe, you would accept a beginner of the universe. And so the scientific community realized this. It was on their minds. So even though that model essentially won over, it was with a little bit of regret by the scientific community. And so the evidence basically piled up, and you could read here in the quote, the shift in scientific opinion after millennia of opposition represents the most significant change science can ever make towards biblical philosophy. So this is intriguing, because what the Bible has been saying the whole time, for say 6,000 years or whatnot, the scientific community, roughly around 1950, finally embraced that the universe had a beginning. So it turns out that the Big Bang happens to be strong evidence for the biblical position that God created the earth, that the universe had a beginning. God caused it to begin. And space, the space-time continuum itself began. So what occurred before, what kind of time was there before space-time started? Christians need an answer to this question. So I'm going to propose it to you. What kind of time was there before the space-time singularity? if time began at the Big Bang? Eternity past, that's a good way to put it. Do you like that word, class? What does that mean? What kind of time was God, if God's the Big Banger, what kind of time was God living in if time had not began? There was no time. What's that? There would be no time. Then how did God exist? What kind of existence can you have if there's no time? Say it? Did you say it? God is timeless. He's not affected by time? Yeah. So what does it mean to exist timelessly? He was, he is, he always will be. Okay, he's omnipresent in that sense in time. Okay, we can think of it that way, yeah?
Does that mean that there is no spatial component that's relevant? Since you talk about time and space being something that's together.
It's time and
space. Isn't there the space, isn't there?
Well, that's definitely true. So God is not a physical thing, is he? He's a spiritual. So does God need a physical place to exist? No. Spirits are not physical. They could care less about the physical reality in front of them. So when we talk about timeless God that you mentioned, Wei, there's two views of time. Christians need to know this. And this is not in your notes. This is free of charge. Two views of time. One view is called static time. Okay? Like static electricity. The other view is called dynamic time. And philosophers know this as the B theory of time. And then there's the A theory. Of course, because if you have A, you got to have B, right? So the idea here is that we live in dynamic time. This is the time we dwell in. Time flows from one moment to another, from one succession of moments to another succession of moments. The past does not exist. As soon as I speak it, it's gone. The future does not exist. The only thing that exists is the present, the now. The past did exist. The future will exist. But as time comes and goes, it comes in and out of existence. This is dynamic time. This is what we live in. This is what we could say. This is what you really want to do, Christian. You really want to say, God, prior to, in some sense prior, the Big Bang, the moment of creation, whatever that was, whether you're a young earther or old earther, God existed in what you could call static time, or people sometimes call it eternity past. This is a better technical term, static time. It has to do with someone dwelling or something existing timelessly. And this is essentially what God dwelt in before he created the universe. And then we want to say, as Christians, that God moved into or became a part of dynamic time, which he created. He basically incarnated himself, if you will, into dynamic time and space, but not physically.
Is that a necessary correlation if God exists outside of his own creation?
Well, I want to say, and I think most theologians would agree with me, that God, it's necessary that God moves into dynamic time for him to have relationship with us, for him to respond to our prayers. Some theologians will try to argue, and this is hard to do, but they do it anyway, that God still exists in dynamic time. He never came into he still exists in static time. He never came into dynamic time with us. So he still is timeless, even now. So when I send my prayers to him, he's up there hearing them. Well, how does he respond? Well, some theologians say that he set in motion the response at the beginning of time and space. So all that the Big Bang contained was not only the fascinating complexity of every body in the universe, but he built into there the responses to our prayers, miracles, divine interventions, words of knowledge, prophecy, everything. So it's very strange to prove this. But for me, what makes the most sense is that God moved into dynamic time, and this is evidenced mostly at the cross with Jesus. That Jesus was physically in our world. And in order to be in our world physically, you definitely have to be in dynamic time. Interesting? He's not. He's a time-sensitive God. That doesn't cause his being to be diminished in any way, or his attributes to be reduced. Sorry. But yeah, that's not something God has to... There's no problem with that, theologically speaking. But some would argue, and this gets into theology a lot, that... his aseity or his changelessness is part of is one of his attributes. And if God is in dynamic time, then he's changing because he responds to our prayers, that sort of thing. So some would say they don't want to say that God's in dynamic time. They want to say that he's still in static time and timeless because they want to say that God is changeless and he's the same. So you could think about that at the break. Okay, we'll take one more question here. Well, that. But if you're a soul, say you die and your soul lives on, you're a spiritual creature now, but you're still living on in dynamic time. So time, you can still live in dynamic time even though you're spiritual. But that's a good question. What is time? This is such an intriguing question. How can you define time? How can you state what it is? You can't. Try to describe it. It's very hard. Augustine, in the 4th century, one of the most brilliant thinkers, not just Christian, but secular and Christian alike, said, time, when I try to define it, I can't. I live in it, I know what it is, but I can't define it. It was a problem for him way back then as a philosopher and theologian. And time has always perplexed theologians and philosophers. There's a whole branch of philosophy called philosophy of time, where philosophers sit around and write articles and scholarly journal reports about what time is. So anyway, time is very complex and confusing. So let's just finish this, take a break. Item 10, now much of the scientific community and the people on the street attempt to postulate alternative ways the universe may have begun, and then you could see the class notes, to avoid the problem of Genesis. And the problem of Genesis is that the universe had a beginning. Scientific community does not like the problem of Genesis. They don't want to have the universe having a beginning. They want the universe to always have been here. And it's been said that whatever you say has been here for forever, or has existed for eternity, God or the universe, God or nature, that is your God. So if you're a secular person and you hold that an eternal universe, whether it's multiverse or black hole created universe or whatever, then universe is your God. So there's some things for you to think about. Why don't we take a quick break and come back and we'll continue this discussion. All right. And I think there's some snacks in the back, right? Cool. Thanks. Why don't we get going here? Chemistry. What sort of chemical evidence is there for an old universe? What sort of chemical evidence, or what does chemistry give us that reveals an old universe? How does chemistry help us determine the universe is super old? carbon
dating?
Don't bring up dating here. We don't. There's a few people that don't want to talk about dating. But if you're interested in talking about speed dating, Christian speed dating, see me after class, because I have a solution for you called Christian Speed Match. And I'm no way affiliated with this organization other than my wife started it. But I do not benefit from the proceeds she does. Right? Okay. So, radiometric dating, again, doesn't have to do with online dating. A method of dating geological specimens by determining the proportions of particular radioactive isotopes present in a sample. So, there's a way to do it, right? That's all we need to know. It has to do with isotopes and stuff like that. Carbon-14 dating has revealed an old Earth as it has dated fossils back as far as 1 billion years. Now, who knows why carbon-14 dating possibly could be suspect as not good evidence. Yes? Okay. Okay, maybe there has to be some sort of chemical or something in there, or otherwise you can't do the dating process. Any other reasons why young Earth Christians like to say, you can't use carbon dating in for the old Earth Christian position?
You're assuming that it actually decayed at the same rate.
Very good. So,
environmental, other things can influence.
Okay. Yeah, so when the sun rays are crashing into the Earth, at the top of the Earth's atmosphere, allegedly when they crash into nitrogen, it produces carbon-14. And the trick of this is that if the atmosphere of the Earth has not been uniform over the past, say, thousands of years, then you don't have the similar decay rate, I believe, of carbon-14. And so then you can't use it to determine whether or not something is old. So the young earthers will bring that up to the old earthers as a refutation. However, in a completely separate test, totally different than carbon-14, isotope separation mass spectrometers, which is the little device, help measure the radiation decay of uranium-thorium. And there are other dating techniques that are in use, such as potassium-argon. So just because carbon-14 may have some issues doesn't mean that there aren't other chemistry-related dating techniques that are valid and appropriate. Okay, so that's we see astronomy helping, chemistry helping. What about geology? Now, how are rocks dated? When you're a geologist and you go look at the Grand Canyon, how do you date that, the layers of tape measure?
Yeah, don't they date it by what strata they are
in? Strata, but how do you know how old one strata is relative to another?
According to the textbook that I was reading recently, they determine the age of the rocks by the fossils that are in them.
Well, how do you know the fossils are old?
They determine the age of the fossils by the rocks that are in them.
Okay, so there's a little bit of circular reasoning there. Yeah, you use the rocks to determine the fossil age, you use the fossil age to determine the rocks. It doesn't really work. Well, it turns out geology also uses radiometric dating. They can look at the different chemical properties of the rock formation itself using the same chemical dating techniques. And so the idea here is that if you do these same experiments on the rock, you can come up with the age of the rock. So if you go to the United States Geological Survey, which is widely used across the globe, and it's highly referenced because it has basically some of the most advanced and up-to-date knowledge and technology related to the seismic activity of the Earth. It states that the age of the Earth and moon rocks and of meteorites are measured by the decay of long-lived radioactive isotopes of elements that occur naturally in rocks and minerals, and that decay with half-lives of 700 million to more than 100 billion years to stable isotopes of other elements. So basically, we don't have to get into all this, but when you're a geologist, you look to the USGS for some good information. So I'm in the field of structural engineering and seismic engineering. So a lot of our resources come from USGS. And so when they say something about how dating works, that's as good as it gets. And this is organization USGS is referenced worldwide. I mean, every structural engineer across the globe who deals with seismic activity, designs for that, uses USGS as a reference point. So other ways that this is done, if you go to the next page, just a couple different ways you could do this to date the Earth using from a geological perspective. The global uniform sedimentation rate is used to extrapolate back to the formation of rocks about 600 million years ago. So basically how things erode, essentially, that erosion rate, that sedimentation rate, is important in dating rocks. Now, you can use this to get things back to 600 million years ago. That's obviously not 14 billion years that they say, or 4 billion years, the age of the Earth. But it's just another way you could say, hey, look, the Earth is super old. You know, it's not 6,000 years. Or you can use the uniform deposition of uranium salts into ocean. That could be used to extrapolate back to the oceans being over 1 million years old. I mean, obviously that's not as long, but this is just another way you can say, okay, look, we have this this rate of deposition into the ocean, so this is a way we can date the ocean as being super old. And so while these sedimentation and deposition rates, dating techniques do not speak of the age of the Earth being 4 billion years old, they do tell of an old Earth. So they're not trying to say that this is a way to show that the Earth is 4 billion years. All they're trying to do is just say, hey, look, if we just look at this, it reveals an old Earth. So nothing too exciting there. But these are just ways somebody could use science to date the age of the Earth. And biology, of course, if you hold to macroevolutionary theory, you would be someone who subscribes to this entire paradigm that the Earth is old, and based on the macroevolutionary rate of mutation, you would have to have an old Earth for us to be here. So we've talked about the evidence for macroevolution and how it has its flaws, and we talked about how it's easy to refute macroevolution in past classes and past outlines if you want to look back to that. So we're not really using biology and macroevolution, to me, and perhaps to you, it's not a good way to date the Earth, because macroevolutionary theory has problems that have not and cannot be overcome. So now, old Earth theories differ with respect to the creation activity or lack thereof on the Earth. So when you go back to that original chart on the first page of this outline, we're going to start looking at the less popular old Earth theories, kind of in the middle of the page there, under old Earth. So the other less popular views are things people hold to, or the way they kind of hash out how this all works. So you don't just say, I'm an old Earth creationist. You have to say, okay, explain it all. You know, you have to refine your view a little bit. You have to develop a more nuanced, sophisticated view. So a way you could do that is you could say, well, I hold to one of these subviews. So deistic creation. Have you heard the word deism before? Or deistic something? What does deism mean, essentially?
God.
Okay, what else? In relation to science.
God created, and then that was it. Started things in motion,
and then just okay, God's not personal. God created a bunch of stuff. He set back and let it unfold. Yeah, so that's kind of the idea. So God was active in his supernatural act of creation only at the very beginning of the universe. He set up laws and let the universe unfold according to his plan, and he was done creating after the initial event. He was not involved in further developments. And someone who holds this could also say that evolution was programmed into the initial creation event, or God may have created the process once the earth was formed. So God could have been distant from creation, except maybe he let the earth kind of develop and form into some mass, and then he intervened just for that point to set up evolution. Or he could have caused evolution to unfold just from the Big Bang singularity, and then it all just worked out. So that's the idea of deistic creation. And you, if you hold to this, you would be an old earther. Now, that one's a little unique. It's a little hard to believe, hard to adopt. But some of these may be a little easier. So gap theory. What is gap theory? Have you heard of that? This could be also called restitution theory, progressive creation, progressive creative catastrophism theory, or creation, reunion, and recreation theory. So if you come across these words, you'll kind of be able to identify it as gap theory. And adherents to this views include these guys. Have you ever heard of any of those guys? Maybe, I'm not sure. Okay. Awesome. That's good. I've never heard of any of these guys, so thank you.
If your creature is an art, people would sell a barn
horse. Oh, yeah? Oh. Okay. I'll have to check him out. Here, the idea is that God created the earth perfectly, but due to the catastrophe caused by Satan in the Garden of Eden, God had to remodel the earth in 6 literal days. So the earth was created super old, and then God remodeled it. And there is a large gap of time, several billions of years, between the catastrophe and the remodeling. Oh, I'm sorry. So God created it in 6 days, then Satan caused the catastrophe, and then there is a huge gap of time, and then God remodeled it afterwards. And so you have this gap of time where all the geological rock formations kind of took shape and so forth. So this is the gap theory, that God created early, within 6 days, and then kind of remodeled it. Or he created it and then redid it in some way, shape, or form, because Satan caused the catastrophe. Yes, sir?
Which satanic catastrophe?
Probably when Eve ate the apple. Possibly. But I would say it's probably, if you think about it, it's probably more that when Satan fell like lightning, that's when he jacked everything up, and then God had to remodel it. Something like that. It could be billions of years ago. Yeah. So this is a view some these guys hold. I'm not sure why, but it could work and correlate to the science pretty well. That's the idea, that we're trying to have a view here that correlates to the Bible and science, if you didn't get that. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, well, I'm not going into details. I'm just giving you...
But you said it, that you believe there's 2 6-day periods, that if you believe that...
If you believe this view, no, I think there's 1 6-day period. Yeah. He created it perfectly, say, in an instant, I don't know. And then he took the 6 days after Satan messed it up. Yeah. Yeah.
Dark.
Yeah.
But the earth existed already. It says the earth was formless and void. But he didn't say that he created the earth.
Well, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So then.
And the earth was without form and void.
Right. So it seems as if the earth showed up in a dark situation, which is what you said.
Yeah. But it was there. It was dark, but it was there.
Yeah, he put it there in the darkness. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so let's keep moving. Because if we get caught up, we'll never get through this. Also known as the... Okay, this is the next view. Pictorial day theory, another view. This is also known as the framework hypothesis or revelation day theory or moderate concordism theory. And adherents to this view include these guys. And the idea with this view is that the 6 days of Genesis 1 are really the 24-hour periods in which Moses revealed or received the revelation from God concerning what took place during the origin of the universe and creation of man. So this is the idea that Moses is sitting there writing out stuff, and the first day when Moses got started to write stuff, it was the first day. So he said, basically, this is what took place on the first day I'm writing, blah, blah, blah. Then it was evening and morning on the second day. And then God revealed what happened next on day two of his writing. And then Moses said, on day two, this is what took place, blah, blah, blah. So the 6 days is really what relates to Moses and has nothing to do with the creation timeline. That's what this view says. So it's a pictorial day view, that this is the picture given to Moses on 6 straight days. And that's how Moses said it. He just used his own days that he was writing in to describe all this. So item 4, the 6 days do not reveal the time, to relate to the time it took God to create, but just the timing of the revelation Moses received. And 5, that science reveals an old universe and earth is irrelevant to the fact that the days in Genesis do not relate to creation event periods. So science will always be compatible, and the authority or integrity of the Bible are not in question. So whatever science says, it is. Who cares what science says? Because all this is doing is it's relating to how Moses received it. He received it in 6 consecutive days. So it's totally irrelevant what science says. 7, based on this position, the religious and theological intent of Genesis account is held in high regard. So Genesis is trying to reveal a theological notion to the reader, not necessarily a scientific understanding. The whole Genesis account is not to be understood as conveying scientific descriptions of the sequence or details of creation events. It was presented by Moses for theological and devotional purposes only. And you have to keep in mind that the other Babylonian accounts or Canaanite accounts of the creation of the universe were very different than the Hebrew account. The Greeks, the same thing. The Hebrew account said God created ex nihilo, Latin for out of nothing, meaning nothing existed at all, not even space itself. Space was not here, not even time itself. There was an absence of anything. That's what nothing means. Not empty space. That's not what nothing is. Empty space is something. Out of nothing means the absence of anything at all. So ex nihilo is the Hebrew notion that God, a spirit, created space-time. Different than the Canaanite, different than the Babylonian accounts of the creation of the world, because they had their own. So that's like ancient Near Eastern creation stories is kind of how that's referred to. And so this was mind-boggling when other cultures heard this, what the Hebrews believed. And so the Genesis account, scholars and commentators say, was written for devotional and theological purposes only, not to reveal a scientific account, to be read through the modern scientific eyes. So that's kind of the idea with this figurative approach to Genesis 1. So just think about this. Again, I'm not advocating any of this. I'm just giving it to you so you can think about it. Now, the next view that's less, again, all these are the less popular views, is this is the local creation theory. This is also known as Eden-only theory. Okay, so adherents include these guys. Again, when I say these guys, these are smart Bible commentators or theologians in the centuries past or current. The events described in Genesis 1 only pertain to the Garden of Eden and do not relate to the rest of the earth. Okay, it was a local creation, just in the garden. That science reveals an old universe and Earth is irrelevant to the fact that the count in Genesis only relates to the Garden of Eden, which is now gone. So science will always be compatible, and the authority or integrity of the Bible are not in question. All right. Any questions on these? I know we're not really dwelling on them too much, but I'm just trying to give you a heads up on what these theories express, and people actually hold to them. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Well, not just the question of evolution, but the what we observe in astronomy and chemistry.
Yeah, just trying to answer.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, doesn't matter, because the Bible doesn't really say this.
Well, these theories, like I said, some of these guys are lived and died 100 years ago. So some of these theories have been around for a while. Augustine, I've mentioned before, he seemed to have held to an old earth position in the 4th century, believe it or not. The young earth position really gained prominence amongst evangelicals when Bishop Usher in the, I believe, 14th century or so, developed this genealogical timeline where he took all the genealogies and the ages of people and their deaths, and he calculated back 4004 BC was the, at 12:30 in the afternoon, was when the earth was created. He put a date on it and a time during that day when the earth was created. And it finally gained momentum. I mean, it was a big book he published, and all this calculation in the book. You know, this is 600 years or something ago, Bishop Usher. And so finally, the Protestant community adopted this, and the evangelicals, you know, hailed it as, hey, we know what's going on. So this young earth idea gained a lot of prominence. Before then, it really wasn't thought about much. But I believe Augustine and maybe even Aquinas, theologians in the 12th century, held to an old earth position amongst Christians. Probably others too, but these are more the prominent authors that we still study. Jewish theologians, Moses Maimonides, I think his name is, and Maimonides, and a couple other Jewish writers, I believe, held to some form of an old earth position. But it wasn't written about much. Okay, theistic evolution. Now here's the big one. We're going to try to get through this, a lot of this, tonight. Now, we talked about criticisms of macroevolution in the past classes. So, if you're a theistic evolutionist, you hold to macroevolution, that species changed and evolved over time. Okay, so that, as we have seen, already has problems scientifically speaking, macroevolution itself. But let's get into this idea of theistic evolution. In the past, theistic evolutionist was a term that was used for any Christian who believed that the earth was old. So, if you're around 1800 and you held to the old earth person position, or say you're around like 1850 after Darwin, people would call you an old earth, or people will call you a theistic evolutionist. So this was just any position that was an old earth position. This guy, Asa Gray, was a scientist and contemporary of Darwin, who first proposed a form of this view when he discussed with Darwin if God could have used evolution to develop the diversity of species. So he was basically in conversation with Darwin saying, hey, God could have guided the evolutionary process. He could have been the intelligent designer of the process and the causer of the process. Kind of like we talked about how Henry Ford was the designer of the internal combustion engine. Okay? And the designer of the assembly line to let these cars unfold or take shape. So Christian proponents of theistic evolution include the BioLogos organization in San Diego, people in the American Scientific Affiliation, these guys, Charles Babbage, Alfred Russel Wallace, these other guys, and possibly C.S. Lewis. Many people think C.S. Lewis held to a theistic evolution view. It's interesting, Calvin College, which is usually considered a conservative evangelical school, kind of like Biola, undergraduates teaches the undergraduate part of Calvin College. Some of the professors there teach this view, theistic evolution, to the students. But it turns out that the seminary at Calvin College teaches the graduate students to become pastors is critical of this view. So even on the same campus, you may have differing opinions, even at evangelical schools. Other Christian colleges are starting to teach this around the country. Probably not too many, but they're starting to, as a possible view. Many of those who hold this view are mainline evangelical Christians, believe it or not, who hold to all of the specific and particular tenets of the same faith I enjoy and you enjoy. So it turns out that many of these folks are brothers and sisters in the faith and have a heart to serve the Lord Jesus Christ with all of their being. So they may hold to theistic evolution that God caused and guided the evolutionary process and be just as passionate about Jesus, just as church-going as you and I. They're our brothers and sisters. Other Christians who hold this view are more liberal in their theology and are not evangelical. So someone may say, I'm a Christian, I go to church once a year, but I love God, I love Jesus. They may go to like some liberal sort of denominational church or something, and they hold to this view. So Christians of all stripes. And the main view is this, that God continues creation through indirectly guiding all life forms through the process of evolution. And that's the idea of natural selection on random mutations, which we talked about. The biblical account of creation, special revelation, is figurative. And in this sense, it is compatible with the scientific account of creation, general revelation. So the idea of the days in Genesis are obviously representative of epochs of time. Okay, D, varying positions of theistic evolution. So within this view of theistic evolution, there's a spectrum of views. There are varying positions, but all of these views basically share these beliefs, that it is essential to stick to the majority scientific opinion on the origin of the universe and the origin of life on Earth. So whatever science says it is, it is. And then common descent from a common ancestor. So we really did come from the pre-mortal soup on the earth full of chemicals. So you could call this a version of this view fully gifted creationism. And you can get proponents like the physicist Howard Van Til at Calvin College. And he holds this idea that when God created the universe, he gifted the initial creation with all the physics, chemistry, and biology that would produce everything that he wanted to produce. Kind of a deistic evolution view. And that's what I'm saying in C. Now, 3 is another version of this view, evolutionary creation. Proponents of this view, including, interestingly enough, Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project. You may have heard of that. Francis Collins is a Christian, and he basically became the founder of the BioLogos organization, which Carl Giberson and Daryl Falk now run in San Diego. Now, Francis Collins was promoted by Obama himself to be the head of the National Institute of Health in Washington. So that's a huge responsibility, and he holds this position. And he's a Christian again. And the idea here is that God worked through gradual natural processes of evolution, not the view of evolutionism as a form of scientism, just evolution, macroevolution, to create and develop all life, but this gradual natural process is a supernaturally led process, like we talked about. And this is a way that Christians should understand the universe and the earth and organisms here. This is how we study God's created order. We study it through the lens of macroevolution. That's this view. So in order to understand God better, you adopt the paradigm of macroevolution when you do your science. And that will help you in understanding the universe that God made. The Bible teaches truth and is compatible with science. The proponents of this view are Christians who hold that the Bible is fully inspired word of God. That's a big doctrine to hold to, by the way. Darwin's natural selection is not contrary to theism. There's no conflict here. It's all the same. It's all the same reality that we're looking at. God's reality. Yes, yes, I'm presenting their position, or this position. Proponents fully embrace this process as God's method and take no exception with it. It's exactly how it unfolded. This is how we got here. Macroevolution. Evolution, both microevolution and macroevolution, is a God-ordained process. And Biologos says on their website, "We marvel at its beauty and are in awe that we have the privilege of experiencing macroevolution." It's an amazing process of how life developed. God designed this process, and we are now amazed at God because He gave us the process of macroevolution. Proponents hold to a form of intelligent design, but do not reject evolution as some ID proponents do. So they are ID theorists in the sense that God was the intelligent designer of the process, but you can be an ID theorist, obviously, and not hold to macroevolution. This equates to evolutionary creationists believing that God caused evolution to produce life according to His design, and this could be called intelligent causation. That's another way to think about it. And you could learn more from their website or reading their books that I listed here. I've heard Carl Giberson debate a creationist of some sort. Carl Giberson is a good guy. He looks like any other scientist, born-again Christian, and he holds that this view is the right view to hold, and so do these other guys. And so it's nothing to be afraid of. It's nothing to be freaked out about. It's something to investigate and consider why you do not hold to this position. There's another form of this. Okay, so we can move on. Key features of theistic evolution. This is some of the bullet points here of this view. Evolution is true and compatible with Christian theism and the Bible. God exists and is the creator. This idea includes the problem of suffering and the fall of humans into sin is accounted for in this view. The figurative reading of Genesis, the appropriate one, and it complements the evolutionary development of all creatures. So when you look at this view and the Bible, they try to make sense of it. It all correlates, collaborates, it's cohesive, it's a uniform integrated system of theology and science. Humans are not unique from primates, this is interesting, but have continued to develop beyond our primate relatives. So humans have mental capacities, faculties and capacities as primates, only with increased capacities in linguistics, mathematics, and psychology. So we're just like them in every way, shape, and form, but we're just a little bit better. There's no essential difference between us and the primates. We're just an advanced form of a primate. There's no barrier, if you will, that we've crossed. There is no difference in kind, only difference in degree. So we've just kind of gotten a little better. Just degrees better than the primates. When Genesis speaks of according to its kind, it is figuratively referring to the work of evolution producing categories of animals, or it's referring to the categorical in-kind reproduction of animals after natural selection has run its course to distinguish them from other creatures. So the idea is that natural selection runs its course, you get a diversity of species, and then when the Bible says every species produced after its kind, that just means that once the tree, if you will, you remember the tree that we talked about? Once that tree kind of developed, then they started reproducing after their own kind, like Genesis says. So that's kind of the idea here. And then we'll do this three, and then I'll take a question. The bad designs of this world. Some people point to bad designs, like why would God create us with this kind of thing? The bad designs of this world are not God's fault, but are just unintended bad output of the process of evolution. So it wasn't God that caused the bad designs that we have to deal with. Evolution caused it. So we point to the eye, or the human jaw shape. Our jaw is apparently weak-shaped. It doesn't have a lot of good structural integrity. The narrowness of the birth canal. The human backbone is strangely shaped. So these kind of bad designs, that was not God's fault, it was evolution's fault. And this idea there in 5, I'm skipping 4, upholds God's omnipotence and omniscience as a perfect creator. So God's still perfect. He's still omnipotent, omniscient. It wasn't his fault. And so the bad designs, we can't blame on him. And as a result, Christians can feel more competent in defending a perfect creator instead of defending a creator who makes bad designs, if one holds to a direct creation at one's view. So if you're a young earth person and you hold that God created everything at once, boom, zap, there it is, there's Adam, there's all the animals, well then, Mr. Christian, how do you explain these bad designs if God is perfect and he creates perfect things? But if you hold to this view, you don't have to have that trouble. Okay, F, before that, there's a question. Carrie? Yeah. They're not accountable. Primates don't sin. People that can sin, or entities that can sin. Entities that can't sin, can't, or don't. Yeah. So how does something go from an entity that can't sin to something that can sin? That's what this next thing is getting into. Theistic evolutionists argue that the figurative reading of Genesis 1-3 is the correct interpretation. The account is mythical. It's not actual. It's a myth. In a way, in that it was a story meant to convey deeper truths or principles that can be passed on from generation to generation through oral communication, as their writing was not available. So how did Moses get this stuff? This information, did he get it from God revealing it, or did the generations before him pass it on through the oral teaching method? Well, interestingly, the style of the narrative is not the genre of a modern scientific research paper, they argue. Therefore, we cannot read it with a modern scientific perspective. We can't just walk out of the lab and then go read Genesis and say, okay, this is a scientific scholarly journal article. No, it's a mythical account, they say. Other people groups of the time actually did not have a robust creation story that the Hebrews did. They did have a creation story, like I mentioned, but it was very different. And like I mentioned, that God created ex nihilo, and God was apart from his creation in the Hebrew account, whereas in the other ancient Near Eastern accounts, you have a God who took matter, which was already in existence, and just rearranged it, formed it, shaped it, whereas God created matter in the Hebrew account. And they say the Hebrew word for Adam actually means man. And so what that means is just mankind in general. So Adam was just a representative that Moses used to tell a mythical story, but in reality, there's a bunch of humans already around. So when he says Adam, he just means all of mankind. So it was kind of mythical. The figurative ancient Near Eastern story narrative reading can still teach and make sense of these really important biblical themes. Marriage, stewardship, we find that in the Bible, in the Genesis account, even with a mythical reading. Original sin, this answers the question you just had. I don't want to get into that now, I'll just let us read it on our own time. But again, God is the creator. And then you have other themes like creation is separate from the creator, creation is good, human free will, human responsibility, and order in creation. These are all in a mythical reading. Questions on that? No, there is. Yeah, the common ancestor is that, you know, one-celled amoeba, if you will.
So that a whole bunch of humans can develop around the same time.
Yeah, so eventually, once you get a bunch of primate-like creatures, then those eventually evolve, macro-evolve to humans.
Or, so would there be a situation where God breathed into all of them at once? Is that what?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. So the idea here is that, and again, this goes into the next topic, great segue, thank you very much. Eventually, human-like creatures, hominids, greater in form and function than primates, but lesser than Homo sapiens, are developed. So eventually, through the macroevolutionary process, you're going to get human-like creatures. We could call them hominids, for instance. They're kind of hobbit-like sorts of humans. They're not fully Homo sapiens, but they eventually came on the scene. So hominids reproduce to increase the population of living hominids. So there's a bunch of hominids around, and they don't have a soul. They're just a body. They're kind of like an advanced form of a primate. Monism is the view that these creatures have one life form as opposed to two natures, body and soul, which is what we have, and we hold to a dualistic view of ourselves. At some point in history, hominids entered the Garden of Eden and were given the image of God, rationality, and moral consciousness. When God breathed life into them, they were given a soul, essentially, at that point. When it says God gave Adam breath or breathed life into the man, that's what they're saying. They're saying this really means that God gave this group of hominids that found their way into the Garden of Eden, he gave them rationality. He gave them a soul. The hominids that didn't find their way into the Garden of Eden, they didn't get that, and eventually they became extinct. And so when God breathed life into them, item 5, this advances them into Homo sapiens, human beings. So that's how the hominids became humans. They had a moral consciousness. They knew what was sin and what wasn't sin because they had the ability to understand. God gave this group of human-like creatures rationality, moral consciousness, and then that's what makes them cross the barrier, or this difference in degree, was when God breathed life into them. And they were not necessarily the two people, Adam and Eve. That is, they reading in Genesis figuratively, Adam and Eve could be taken to be representations of multiple male and female hominids who entered the garden. Now, the hominids turned into humans, and we talked about that, knowing moral right and wrong, and that's what allowed them to be tempted in the garden. And so then you have the fall, and as a consequence, the hominids turned humans, were forced to live in the harsh and cruel competitive world with struggle and suffering. And that's the world we find ourselves in. And so this is the world where they came from before the garden and is a world that created them. However, only until after the fall that they realized the sufferings in the world is a result of their sin, essentially. That's what I'm saying here. So now we realize that because of our temptation and the sin after we turned human and we fell into it and we gave in, now we're stuck in all this world of suffering. So it kind of aligns with it aligns theologically speaking, this view. When they give you the whole package deal, they make sense of evolution, they make sense of the Genesis evolution, the Genesis account, theology. It's all accounted for in this theistic evolutionary worldview. Now, we don't have time to get into the strengths or the problems of this view tonight, but you can already see how, when it's all unpacked for you, it has a few things that are attractive. A few things. These are the strengths, which we'll get into next week. Are there any questions, though, at this time?